and that many of the soldiers and many of the officers are not part of the Shah's thinking and, you know, weren't killing people, and that this would be a great catastrophe for the country.
If this army was dissolved.
If we dissolved the army. Mm. Not only that, he even wrote letters and spoke to the officers and said, you're part of us. You are, you know, you are our children. We're together in this. You know, you can be your own boss.
Wonderful.
This wasn't, you know, you don't need the American advisors. You yourself have the capabilities. Mm. And many people in the army at that time were actually quite religious. So this was they were trying to portray this image as the army being like the army of Turkey or Egypt, which is completely
irreligious. Yeah, but they had religious sympathies.
But most of the members of the army, whether it was Air Force or Army, the sure. ground troops, or whether it was even the Navy, had religious backgrounds. Yes. And Imam knew this.
Ah.
And he was very clever in not doing this, because at that time you had many of these, you know, later we turned out like the, you know, these terrorists that are now, you know, going to...
Yes, you're referring to the MKO, aren't you?
Right. These terrorists that, alhamdulillah, thank God, no longer
exist now.
They were pressing Imam at that time, dissolve the army, we will be the new army.
Sure.
And can you imagine if that would have happened?
Oh my God.
Right? So this is part of the cleverness.
Yes.
The other part of the cleverness of Imam was, again, as we've talked about many times, understanding who the real and the main enemy is.
Yes.
The real and the main enemy at that time are and is America and Israel.
That's right.
And one of the ways in which they cause trouble is by
dividing
the Muslims.
Yes.
Sunni Shia,
creating tensions amongst
inter Shia,
the Muslims,
inter Sunni,
yes.
Takfiri, this, that, whatever.
Sure.
And so when Imam, as this religious man that he is, as this person who is a complete, you know, representative and leader of the Shias, comes out and he forcefully talks about unity and Islamic unity.
Sure.
And not only does that in terms of his speech, but also does it in action.
In action, yes.
We see that when the Islamic Republic of Iran is established, where in the constitution it is mentioned that the official religion is the Ja'fari Madhab, where we talk about all the basis of the law being the Ja'fari law. And yet we also see that it is also a time where there's a renaissance of the Sunni population.
That's
and
right.
Areas that they live in, the sense that they are allowed to and they practice their own madhab. They have their own courts, they have their own, you know, systems in terms of their personal law.
You sure?
Okay, they're not governed in personal law by the Ja'fari law, and they have representatives and they're
in the parliament. Yes,
you know, they're part of the normal structure of the society.
Society, yes.
And
along with other minorities.
And yes,
as
there
well.
Might have been, from history and, you know, historically speaking, some deprivations in some of the areas, because they do live in marginal areas, for example, in the West or in the East. So
sure.
That's a different issue that has, you know, actually very little to do with their denomination, more of a geographic and historic issue.
Yes.
But in terms of them being able to live in this Islamic Republic in a dignified way, nobody doubts that. And they themselves are the best, you know, testament of that, and you know, you see what happened over the generation, the last 2-3 generations. You really see a marked improvement, and you know, many of the areas, especially if you look at the southeast in Sistan Baluchistan, you really had very high illiteracy rates before the revolution, and now literally everyone, there's schools, there's literacy, there's, you know, development in a way that was, you know, unimaginable years ago.
Sure.
All of it, you know, under the rule of the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is based on the Imami school of Islam. So even within Iran, and you know, they always try to bring in like side issues, like, oh, there, you know, in Tehran there is no, you know, Imam, you know, they don't have the Friday prayers for the Sunnis. Well, you know, you go in most of the cities where the Sunnis are the majority, you have Friday prayers which are you know, headed by the
sure.
by the Sunni
absolutely
denomination, and the Shias go there, and you know, there's joint prayers, like you were saying.
Sure.
And you know, these are not things that, you know, if people want to, you know, cause trouble, they can always find reasons to do that. But the
yes.
reality is completely different.
Yes,
this is on the national level. On the international level, we see that Imam immediately talks about, you know, supporting, for example, the Palestinians. Well,
that's
as
true.
We always say, are the Palestinians Shia or Sunni?
They're Sunni.
Well, they're Sunni.
Yes.
Okay, we're talking about, you know, Imam from the very beginning not allowing this you know, evil cancer, whatever you want to call it, sure. to seep in into yes. the minds of people. And unfortunately, what we see, and this brings us to the situation we're currently in, and all the things we've discussed in terms of Syria and, you know, Al Saud and Takfiris and so on, we see that, unfortunately, from the beginning, as it was during the time of the British, the main tool for causing division within the Muslim world are the Al Saud and the Takfiris.
Exactly.
By how? By declaring everybody else to be kafir.
Yes. Non-believers.
Non-believers. Every other Muslim except for us, according to them, yes. is a non-believer. That's why, because you were mentioning, you know, being bombed during prayer.
Sure.
Well, which Muslim would kill another Muslim during prayer?
During prayer. Exactly.
I mean, this is horrendous. It's completely reprehensible. I mean, this is something no Muslim would do to another mother, to another Muslim.
No.
I mean, imagine, you know, family feud arguments, you know, theological
sure.
disputes.
Sure.
Well, you know, one of the red lines of, you know, where you don't go is you don't kill people during prayer.
Exactly. But they crossed it.
Okay.
The Takfiris have crossed it.
So, you know, this is bad.
This is really bad.
Bad in the sense that, you know, you have now a legion of monsters, of shayateen, you know, with big beards and, you know.
Yes.
Whatever.
Yeah.
You know, they have the shape of, and it's actually, you know what? It's actually, I would like to say it this way. They don't even look, they're a caricature of Islam.
Yes, they're a caricature of Islam. You're
okay.
right.
Okay. Yes. I mean, we have, you know, we have a tradition of having beards. You know, I have a beard. Right?
Yes. yes.
You know, the ulama, they usually have longer beards or whatever. I mean, this is part of the sunnah of the Prophet and, and you know, so there's nothing wrong with having a beard.
Yeah.
But I mean, you just look at these guys and they're caricatures.
Yes.
They don't look normal.
No.
They don't, you know, there's something wrong with them.
Something wrong with them, yes.
You know, they're, when we say extremist, you could just tell they're like...
There's something psychopathic about them, yes.
So, we don't even have them, because I was going to say we have these people who are supposedly the representatives of Islam, or they look Muslim. They actually don't really look Muslim.
No.
They look like a caricature of Islam.
Islam, yes.
Literally.
Literally, yes.
And they are portrayed as being, you know, the representative of Islam.
Mm.
You see in Syria, I mean, it's nuts. I mean, look at what they did in Syria.
I know, it's horrendous.
And the ones that are funding the whole thing and wanting these guys to be the representative of Islam in the world and to wipe out everybody else are the Al Saud.
Yes.
And the reason the Al Saud want this is not because they have some sort of a deep attachment to the, you know, and love for, you know, Abdul Wahhab, you know, or Ibn Taymiyyah or one of these guys who is supposedly the quote-unquote scholars of the Takfiris,
yes.
right? Because you can't even call them scholars.
Scholars, no, right. you can't.
You can't really call them scholars.
No.
It's not that. It's not because they are, you know, holding up the flag of you know, pure Salaf Islam.
Yeah.
Because Salaf Islam doesn't kill other Muslims.
No, it doesn't.
Right?
No.
So it's really about using these and exploiting these ignorant people in order to stay in power.
Exactly.
In Saudi Arabia, in order to have control over the oil fields,
sure,
which is, you know, billions and billions, in order to have control over Mecca and Medina, which is billions and billions.
Billions, yes.
And this is all it's about.
Yes.
You know, neither King Abdullah nor any of the other, you know...
No, it's all about money and
old
power.
Guys and, you know, brothers and half-brothers and cousins and uncles. None of those guys care about, you know, pure Islam.
No, they don't. They care about power and money.
They care about Al Saud staying in power, yeah. and they will do whatever it takes to do that. And if it takes them, you know, unleashing, you know, a legion of wacko, you know, terrorist organ eaters and, you know, cannibals and heart eaters.
Yes.
And, you know, people who will cut off heads with... I'm purposely mentioning the things they're doing. So
yes,
people
exactly.
realize what they're doing. I apologize.
They literally sawed the heads off.
They didn't saw them. No, no, brother. They didn't saw them. They used kitchen knives. Okay? And, you know, going around, for example, cutting the heads off priests.
Yes.
You know in Islam
horrible.
And in the Quran what it says?
Yes, I know.
It says we have to protect the churches.
Yes, we have to protect the people of the book.
We have all the rivayat that talk about, you know, us, you know.
We are not allowed to
we're
do,
not
touch
this
them,
is not,
violate
they are
them
not
in any
kafir.
Shape or form.
They're not kafir in the sense of being
no,
kafir
they're
harbi.
Not.
They're not. We're not in war against them. They're living under the protection of Islam and Muslims. You're not allowed to do this, you crazy person.
Hmm.
You have to respect them. And yet they do it.
They do it. So that shows the real evil nature.
It shows that they are not Muslim. They don't understand Islam. No. They don't know the Quran. They don't know anything.
No, they don't.
Okay? They're just there to
create chaos.
The Saudis and the Israelis cause division.
Exactly.
So, having said all that,
yes,
we get to the current times. Mm. Well, we see that the Supreme Leader, may God protect him,
yes, please,
continuing the line of Imam, talking about that we have to maintain Islamic unity. So many years now, he's been talking about Islamic unity. At a time when others weren't even talking about it, he was talking about that we should have Islamic
sure.
unity.
Sure, yes.
He's talking about the fact that this division, Sunni Shia divisions, are the making of the enemies of Islam. And it's very interesting. Again, you have a person like the Supreme Leader, again, Ayatollah Khamenei, you know, a leader of the Shias. He's from the, you know, Imami school. And he talks about that it's takfiris, mainly on the so-called. He says they call themselves Sunni, but they're not Sunni. And then he says there's even some on the Shia side.
Yes.
He talks about them.
This kind of extremism, takfirism, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah,
from the Shia side.
Coming from the Shia side and condemning it.
Yes.
And not only condemning it, but issuing the fatwas that are required to condemn it.
Talking about
not cursing, you know, the personalities that are important to the different denominations.
Exactly.
Talking about unity, okay?
Sure.
So it's not simply, you know, rhetoric. It's actually action.
No. It's also education, isn't it, as well? Because he's educating us as how to be brothers with one another.
Exactly. Because this is what Islam is.
Exactly. Okay. That's what it's all about.
Right. Mm. And the point is simply this. The differences that we might have pale in comparison to the dangers we face from the enemies.
And the enemy, yes, that's true.
Okay?
Yeah.
This is the point. Mm. Nobody is trying to, you know, compromise on our deep-held beliefs. And, you know, everybody knows how much we love the Ahlul Bayt and how much we consider them to be the way in
which... The best examples for us to follow.
And the way in which we can, you know, get close to God.
Get close to God and understand Islam,
because
course.
They are the ones that teach us real Islam.
Yes.
Okay? They're the ones that tell us, you know, to understand... This is our basic belief as Imami Muslims.
Absolutely.
Is that we have thaqalain, we have Quran, and we have Ahlul Bayt.
Yes.
And they're together.
They're together, yes.
Okay, and if you don't have one, then you don't have Islam.
Exactly.
So if you don't have Quran, but you have Ahlul Bayt, you don't have Islam. If you have Ahlul Bayt, if you have Ahlul Bayt and you don't have Quran, you don't have Islam.
Exactly.
So, you know, this is our belief. So nobody's trying to compromise on that or trying to,
that's not what it's about.
But you have to look at the same Ahlul Bayt and how they behaved.
Exactly.
Number
That's
one.
The point.
Number
yes.
two, you have to also be clever.
Mm.
And you have to understand who the real enemy is.
Yes.
And so this is why, because then people might say, well, you always keep going on about Ali Saud and, you know, takfiris, and, well, aren't you doing exactly that? Well, our point in all these is that they are one of the greatest barriers to Islamic unity.
This is the problem.
Because they are neither Sunni nor Shia.
No. They are the enemies of Islam.
They are not a denomination of Islam.
The enemies of
they
Allah.
They look like, you know, they are Islamic, although, they look like caricatures of Islam. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's not about, you know, well, why, if you're saying all this and then you're going ending up attacking the takfiris. Well, the takfiris don't even consider us Muslim, so why should we?
Yeah, exactly. You know? I mean, this is the point. Yes.
So we don't consider them to really be Muslim.
No.
Because no Muslim does these things. It's not simply about saying it with your tongue.
No,
it's not about just, you know, saying shahadatain.
No, it's all on video. It's all on the internet.
It's not just about saying shahadatain.
No.
Okay, so you say shahadatain, and then you end up doing everything which is against, you know, the most basic principles of Islam. So how can you say that person is a Muslim?
Exactly.
Just because they have a beard?
Sure.
Just because they say Allahu Akbar?
No, I mean, the thing is, this is what I was saying in one program myself on this subject, on the very subject of takfiris. I was suggesting that, you know, I mean, we're talking about democracy and talking about systems of government that give quality of life, progression to its people. But what are we going to get with if the takfiris are in power? We have to eat the liver of our neighbors? I mean, is that the way we're going to carry
well,
on?
Well, I think this is what has become so painfully clear in Syria.
Yeah.
Is they were trying to portray this as, you know, the Sunni masses rising up against the evil Alawi dictatorship and the Shia dictatorship.
Sure.
And the majority of Sunnis were like, hey, wait a second. You know, we don't want to be...
With them.
No, we're not with them.
No, no.
Okay?
Because I don't want to eat my neighbor
This
tomorrow.
Is not what Sunni Islam is.
Yes.
Okay? Mm. This is a problem that we've had over the last 100 years, is that these Takfiris and these so-called Salafis and Wahhabis. And, you know, there's even distinctions between them.
Them as well, yes, true.
Right? Within them, there's even different grades and shades, right? Sure. But let's just call it Wahhabis and Takfiris. Mm. The problem we've had is they were successful in claiming that they're Sunnis. Mm. And yet they're not Sunnis.
No.
They don't speak for the Sunnis.
No, they don't.
And it has to do with the fact that many of the Sunnis in the last 100 years were at a very low level of understanding of religion.
Yes.
In terms of literacy, and it has to go with the civilizational decline that existed in the Muslim world.
That's right.
It has to do with the fact that you had imperial powers coming in. You really didn't have good teachers of Islam.
No.
I'm not saying there were none. There were some.
Yeah.
But the level was low, and so when you had this funding and this movement coming out of Saudi Arabia with all that oil money
and all that
support by the Americans and the British, they were able to
hijack a lot of the
Sunni mosques and centers and so on.
You know, even this al-Nusra front at the moment in Syria, you know, who are the caricatures of Islam as you described it, even they're killing each other, you know, even within their own groupings as well. That even there are several groups that are supposed to be in the Free Syrian Army, but it's neither free nor Syrian,
nor an army,
and they're killing all, you know, each other as well.
Right.
So I mean, what, that's the thing. What exactly. are you going to get at the end of the day?
It's a dead end.
It is a dead end.
You know, this is because there's no reality, you know, as the basis of it. This is why you have the movements that happened, for example, in Iran, or you have movements such as Hezbollah, which happened in
That's
Lebanon,
right. yeah.
you know, being successful in the long run because they're based on reality. They're based on truth.
They're
based on Islam, which is according to the Quran, according to the Sunnah.
Principles of the Quran,
okay?
Yes, absolutely.
And these takfiris are not according to the Quran and the Sunnah. They are the opposite of the Quran and Sunnah.
Exactly.
And believe me, this is the important point, and I really hope that the listeners, you know, can take this away from what we're saying.
Thank you for that.
When we say that the takfiris are not based on Islam, that doesn't mean we're saying they're not Sunnis.
No.
Because if you look at Sunnis, the four madhahib, the different scholars, you know, they have a lot of, you know, the basis is Quran, the basis is the hadith and the rivayat that exist in that school.
Sure.
And they're much closer to the reality of Islam than anything, you know, comparable to it. So don't be fooled. Don't let them say that we are Sunnis. Takfiris are not Sunnis.
No.
Okay?
No.
On the other hand, and I would want to emphasize this, as I mentioned earlier, you know, we have some, and I will clearly say it, mercenaries, some people who are paid by the Americans and the British, who put on, you know, Shia clothing, and they have Shia names, and they have Shia programs on TV and on satellite stations, and they are just as bad as these takfiris, because their takfiris in the other direction.
Yes, right.
Now, of course, they don't send, you know, armies into Syria to cut out the hearts of
people.
But
it's very damaging.
They're part of the same plan and game.
Game.
You have these extremists on this side trying to provoke and trying to, you know, going into Shia towns, for example, and killing, you know, kids and women and whatever, you know, desecrating graves. I mean, what Muslim would go and, you know, break open the grave of a Sahaba of the Prophet?
Prophet. I mean, this is ridiculous.
Why would you do that?
Yeah.
So who cares if he was friends with Ali or not? He's Sahaba of the Prophet.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay?
Exactly.
Why would you do that?
Mm.
What Muslim would do that? Okay.
No, it's unthinkable.
So that's then you have on the other side, you have the Shia mercenaries, the so-called whatever, the Takfiri Shias, you know,
right,
stoking the flames
of division,
right?
Yeah.
Saying, oh, this is this, and calling
and,
people
and
names,
cursing and swearing for no reason,
right?
Yeah. Which is forbidden in Islam.
Against the fatwa of all the Maraji.
Al Maraji, yes.
Okay,
they're not allowed to do that.
When the things were getting out of hand in Iraq, they asked Ayatollah Sistani, may God protect him. He said, you know, they asked him, are the Sunnis our brothers? And he said, they're not only not your brothers, they're your heart and soul.
My God.
This is what he told his followers. He said, they're not only your brothers, they're your heart and soul. You have to sacrifice yourself for them. This is the school of Ahlul Bayt.
Exactly.
Okay? And people are seeing it.
Mm.
People are seeing this. I'm talking about the Sunnis.
Yes.
I'm talking about the majority of Sunnis. I'm talking about the Arabs, you know, of the different, whether it's Sunnis or Christians. They're seeing what the reality is.
No,
they're not getting fooled by the Saudis and by their, you know, crazy
their vicious
preachers
propaganda,
and,
I guess.
And you know, all these guys who come on TV and just spew hate and
yeah,
division.
It is. They're spewing
and just
hatred,
remember
yes.
this, after all is said and done, who benefits? Who benefits?
Israel.
And it's clear
yeah.
that Israel and America and the enemies of Islam benefit from
of
these divisions.
There's so the why would you international community? Isn't
why
it?
Why yeah. would you why would you do something that benefits Israel and America?
Exactly.
Against your fellow Muslim.
Exactly.
Why would you do that? Mm. So alhamdulillah, these things are being said.
Yes, exposed.
Alhamdulillah, the majority of brothers and sisters
are beginning to see
of
now
different
yeah, the reality.
They're also seeing the reality of Shias, that the Shias are not, you know, these extremists, that
no.
they are, you know, mushrik, whatever,
no.
all the...
And that Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, was quite right about what he was saying at that, you know, 35
right.
years ago, that this is going to be
because,
a major
because
problem.
Because we've shown with our action in the last 30, you know, 5 years, that what we say, we also deliver with our action. We
yes.
stick to our friends. We are not extremists. We want everybody to live peacefully.
Sure.
We don't discriminate based on denomination. And this is the way of Ahlul Bayt. This is the way of Imam Ali alayhi salam. This is the way of Imam Hassan alayhi salam. This is the way of Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
Absolutely.
Okay?
Absolutely.
This is who we follow because they are the ones that
May
teach
God
us real
them.
Islam.
Yes.
And it's good. I'm happy because things are moving in this direction.
That's right.
And the key is going to be the Arab populations.
Mm.
This is why the Saudis are freaking out.
Freaking out.
They're freaking out.
Even with the Muslim Brotherhood, in spite of all the mistakes they were making, they couldn't even tolerate them because they knew that what bigger threat this is to their power.
It all comes down to the Arab populations being, you know, becoming familiar with real Islam.
Yes.
Looking at the real Sunnah of the
That's
Prophet.
Right.
Looking
yeah.
at, you know, great Arab personalities and leaders, the greatest Arab ever, Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Islam, of course.
Right?
Of course.
Right? So this is not something that, you know,
very nicely put.
It's their own heritage.
It is their own heritage.
It's their own. It's
Excellent
not like some
point,
Ajami,
yes.
whatever, Majusi
no, it's their
thing
heritage.
Being about. You know, when we're talking about Imam Ali alayhi salam, we're talking about, you know, we're talking about the noblest of noble Arabs. You know?
My God.
Bani Hashim,
exactly.
Okay? So, you know, this is something that, you know, alhamdulillah, through the efforts of media to a certain extent, through the realities that people have seen
on the ground, yes.
The way Iran has behaved, the way, for example, the successes that Hezbollah has had, the changes that have occurred in Iraq.
Yes.
Okay?
Yes.
People are waking up. Mm. And this is why the Saudis are completely freaking out. This is why the Israelis are completely freaking out.
Yes.
Because they know that once the Arabs become familiar with
the
school of Ahlul Bayt.
Yes.
And again, please, let me be very clear about this. It's not about labels.
No.
And we're not talking about people becoming Shia. It's not about that.
No, it's not about a conversion business.
It's about,
no.
you know, call yourself whatever you want.
Want, yes.
Just look at the teaching of Ahlul Bayt.
Right, and learn about Islam.
And you will see
yes.
that this is with fitra. This is your fitra.
Exactly.
If you read Nahjul Balagha, if you read Saifei Sajjadiyah by Imam Sajjad, alayhi salam. Imam Sajjad, Saifei Sajjadiyah is a miracle.
Mm.
It's an amazing thing. It's an
it
amazing
is.
Thing.
Of course.
And if you're Arab and you understand Arabic, you know, it will immediately touch your heart. You will understand that this person is not a normal person. That this person is the one that's following and continuing the tradition of the Prophet, peace be upon him, and is the successor of the Prophet.
And trying to lead us towards perfection.
I'm talking about Imam Sajjad.
And, toward, yes,
and
exactly.
Saifei Sajjadiyah and the prayers that are in there.
Of
and
course.
The way he talks to God.
Mm.
Okay? Anybody who has a heart... Anybody who is a little bit sincere, if you read Saifei Sajjadiyah, how can you not be moved by it?
Exactly.
How can you be not by touched by it as a Muslim? So this is my message, is that don't be fooled. Takfiris are not Sunnis. It's not about labels. It's about following real Islam.
Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, on that note, I'd like to thank you for your valuable contribution on the program today. I hope our listeners have benefited from what you've said today. Thank you very much for that. And for our listeners, it just leaves me to say, Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and mercy and blessings of Allah be upon you all. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line. Iran, Russia, and China began joint military drills in the north of the Indian Ocean on Friday. Dubbed the 2022 Marine Security Belt, the exercises are the third to have been carried out between the three countries. The drills cover 17,000 square kilometers of ocean. Vessels and equipment from both Iran's army and the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps were on maneuvers. A variety of tactical exercises, such as rescuing burning vessels, releasing hijacked vessels, shooting at specific targets, shooting at air targets at night, and other tactical and operational exercises were carried out during the drills. Strengthening the security of the international maritime trade, combating piracy and maritime terrorism, exchanging intelligence in the field of maritime rescue missions, and exchanging operational and technical experience were among the objectives of the 2022 Marine Security Belt exercise.
So I believe that the message is mostly to the people and to the nation, like the United States or other allies, that they want to have, they want to carry on some kind of activities in these areas. And if you ask me if this one is something where it will create a kind of joint action between Iran, Russia, and China, I would say yes, in this area. I don't think that they will tolerate in the future any kind of activities that we can define as terrorist or attack or pirates or these kind of things.
Iran says its presence in the international coalitions manifests the improvement of the Islamic Republic's standing in the world. An Iranian spokesman for the joint drills says Tehran attaches great importance to the establishment of security at regional and international levels. The trilateral exercises come as Iran is taking steps to balance its foreign policy. While talks on the revival of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, and the removal of U.S. sanctions against Iran are underway in the Austrian capital, Vienna, Tehran is expanding its ties with its two key allies, Russia and China. Earlier this month, Iran and China began the implementation of much-anticipated Sino-Iranian pact, known as the Comprehensive Strategic Partnership, a 25-year cooperation agreement that's aimed at strengthening the two countries' economic and political ties. Also last week, Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, said Tehran and Moscow are set to begin working on drawing up a similar roadmap that will shape their cooperation for the next two decades. The statement came as Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi was on a two-day trip to Russia. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization's unanimous decision last September to approve Iran's membership to the bloc after almost 15 years was yet another development signaling the future of Iran's economic and political ties with the East.
I think that the strategy of the geopolitics of the United States is in this area, and I will say basically in Eurasia, is in the way that they don't want the formation of a strong Eurasian continent. So, they're fighting basically against China and very strong against Russia, and they have first the sanction with Iran, and they put a lot of pressure to Iran. So it's normal that these three countries, they will join together from a different point of view.
What this all shows is that Iran's seeking a more balanced foreign policy, and that Tehran isn't staking its future entirely on the fate of the 2015 deal anymore. While making efforts to salvage the deal, it's considering other options to ensure its economic goals are met.
On Monday, Yemen's military launched retaliatory attacks deep inside the United Arab Emirates using drones and missiles to strike strategic targets in the UAE. Yemeni forces targeted a strategic oil facility and a fire at Abu Dhabi's international airport. The Yemeni military conducts regular retaliatory attacks against targets in Saudi Arabia over its devastating war on Yemen. But attacks against the UAE, which is fighting alongside Saudi Arabia, has been rare. It's widely believed that the attacks made UAE officials realize their vulnerabilities. The attacks are the greatest damage to the reputation of the UAE because they have always portrayed themselves as a safe and secure country to do business. Yemeni officials have warned they could target more facilities in the UAE. The years-long war on Yemen has killed tens of thousands of people and pushed the country towards humanitarian catastrophe. Following the retaliatory strikes, Israel offered security and intelligence support to the United Arab Emirates. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett said the regime is committed to working closely with the UAE against Yemeni forces. He also ordered the Israeli establishment to provide their counterparts in the UAE with any assistance. Since joining the Saudi-led coalition in the invasion of Yemen, the UAE has focused on the southern and coastal regions of Yemen. It's also trying to take control of its strategic and resource-rich ports and islands in that region. Socotra is strategically located at the mouth of the Gulf of Aden, overlooking the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, which connects the Red Sea to both the Gulf of Aden and the Arabian Sea. The UAE is annexing the island with the help of the Israeli regime. The UAE is said to be setting up an espionage center for Israel at the Socotra airport in Yemen.
This is not the case. Israel has no business interfering in Yemen any more than Saudi Arabia or the United States do, or the UAE. But by this recent action, which is the people of Yemen simply defending their country and opposing one of the other countries that is causing significant, extreme problems within Yemen.
Al Hilal Emirates Company is said to have signed a contract with Israel to build a spy and intelligence center for the Israeli Air Force at the airport in the city of Hadibo, the center of the Socotra Island. In December of 2021, Bennett became the first leader of the Israeli regime to visit the Persian Gulf state, more than a year after the two sides agreed to establish formal relations under a U.S. brokered deal.
Israel would like to see this as a false flag, would like to convince the United States government and the people of the United States that it must attack Iran because Iran has attacked one of its allies and poses a threat to the existence of Israel. Anything that anyone says or does Israel doesn't like, it considers what it calls an existential threat to Israel.
The UAE officially inaugurated its embassy in Israel in July last year, and then Israel opened its embassy in the Emirati capital in late June. Since they signed a normalization agreement in August last year, Israel and the UAE have signed a raft of deals in various areas, ranging from tourism to aviation and financial services.
Look to the east, the current Iranian administration says that is the policy it is implementing. Tehran prioritizes expanding ties with neighboring and other regional countries. This largely forms the basis of Iran's foreign policy and its deepening ties with eastern powers like China and Russia. The Iranian president's high-profile two-day visit to Russia this week has been widely described as a turning point in relations between Tehran and Moscow. Ebrahim Raisi, who arrived in the Russian capital on Wednesday, sat down for talks with his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin. The two presidents' discussions lasted 3 hours. Bilateral cooperation in the fields of infrastructure, energy, banking, and trade was the main focus of the talks. Putin praised the two neighbors' close cooperation on the international stage. The two presidents tasked Russian and Iranian foreign ministers to work out a roadmap for cooperation over the next 2 decades. President Raisi said the two neighbors will soon finalize their 20-year comprehensive cooperation agreement. During their meeting on Wednesday, Putin and Raisi condemned unilateralism and stressed the need to confront it.
The meeting came as both Iran and Russia are locked in disputes with the United States, which both Tehran and Moscow have condemned for unending unilateralism. Tehran has been targeted by many rounds of unilateral American sanctions, and Russia, already under American sanctions over the situation in Ukraine, is now being threatened again by Washington as tensions over Ukraine run high.
Both Russia and Iran are being subject to the same kind of pressures coming out of Washington by the Biden administration, which is trying to reassert the U.S. hegemony over world politics. They're living in the past. The past has long gone past them by, but they haven't realized it yet, and they're trying to use the power of the so-called Western alliance, which today is very much divided in many respects, to pressure countries like Russia, like Iran, like China.
In an address to Russia's lower house of parliament, Duma, on Thursday, the Iranian president said sanctions are a common form of bullying and domination. He added that fighting the sanctions requires a collective response and cooperation among independent nations. Some observers believe that American sanctions have persuaded targeted nations like Iran, Russia, and China to work together more closely. Meanwhile, Raisi also warned that the United States has forged a satanic alliance with the terrorists. He said complicated plans are afoot now to send the terrorists on a new mission to the Caucasus in Central Asia. Russia and Iran have a history of cooperation in the fight against terrorism in the region, especially in Syria. And observers believe they could act together again if necessary. The Islamic Republic seems to be very serious about its look to the East policy. Becoming a full member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization in September last year is considered a major step in that direction. Also, Iran and China's 25-year strategic cooperation agreement, which the two sides began implementing a few days ago, is another major sign that Tehran wants to enhance relations and exchanges with Asian powers.
That's really where the future is. You're going to see probably a revival of what used to be the ancient Silk Road now with China's Belt and Road Initiative, which now Iran's going to be a part of. And that may, again, put that whole region in the center of economic development to the demise or the lower position by the Europeans and the Americans.
Iran says it is open to more partnerships that benefit both sides and are based on mutual respect.
On Monday, the Yemeni army conducted retaliatory strikes on several targets in the United Arab Emirates. Army spokesman Yahya Sari said the country launched 5 ballistic missiles and a large number of drones at Dubai and Abu Dhabi airports, an oil refinery in Musafa, and several other sensitive and important sites in the UAE. Local officials said 3 people were killed and 6 others injured after 3 fuel tanker trucks exploded in the storage facility of an Emirati oil firm in the Musafa area. Fires erupted in the Abu Dhabi International Airport, disrupting flights. This came just days after the Yemeni army repelled an attack by Emirati-backed mercenaries in the province of Ma'arib, killing and injuring dozens. In a statement, the Yemeni army said Monday's attack inside the UAE was a warning to stop its involvement in the Saudi-led war on the country. The army warned the coalition of more painful attacks if it continues its aggression against Yemen.
Just because it is possible to bully or invade a country with little resistance, such as the cases with Yemen and Saudi Arabia and the UAE, doesn't mean that it should be done, and that countries have more of a responsibility to each other and the international community than they do to their own immediate self-gain. I had the privilege of attending many protests in favor of Yemen and protests to stop the bombing and the harassment of Yemen when I was in New York City. And you can see this is a genuine movement. This is a so many people from all different walks of life are recognizing the horrors that are being committed against Yemen by Saudi Arabia, by the backed UAE, and it has to come to an end.
The Yemeni military has warned that the UAE won't withstand its future strikes. Earlier this week, Yemen said Saudi Arabia had once again seized a ship carrying much-needed fuel while en route to the country's Hodeidah port. Yemeni officials said the vessel had secured UN clearances to enter Yemen, but it was diverted to the Saudi coast of Jizan. Saudi Arabia has seized several Yemeni-bound fuel ships in recent months, despite an ongoing fuel crisis there. Earlier this month, the Yemeni army released footage of a captured UAE-flagged vessel that had trespassed into the country's territorial waters. Army spokesman Yahya Sari said the ship was carrying military equipment and was engaged in hostile acts against Yemen. The United Nations, however, called on Yemen to return the ship. It also condemned the country's recent retaliatory strikes on the UAE and called for all sides to exercise maximum restraint. It made no mention of the Saudi-led coalition's deadly strikes in Yemen.
And the United Nations has no right to demand that this UAE flagship be returned so it can go back into combat and slaughter goodness knows how many more innocent Yemeni civilians. And so I think that, I mean, Yemen should stand strong, the international community, the anti-imperialist international community should stand strong with Yemen and say absolutely not. Unless the UN is going to play fair and be neutral, and in this case be supportive of Yemen and the right to defense, then the UN has no business saying what should and should not be done in this conflict with the UAE.
Saudi Arabia and its allies have maintained a tight blockade on Yemen, where the population is in dire need of basic supplies such as food and medicine. Riyadh imposed a blockade in 2015, the same year that it launched an air campaign on Yemen. Daily airstrikes have hit the country, leaving tens of thousands of Yemenis dead. The attacks have increased in recent weeks. Almost 7 years after the war started, and despite all the hardships the Arab country is enduring, the Yemeni retaliatory attacks are driving home the message that the Yemenis are not backing down until the aggression against their nation is ended.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The attempt to pass voting rights legislation died in the Senate recently, a huge blow to US President Joe Biden and his party, in a year which finishes with midterm elections in which Republicans are expected to prosper. We now present you an article written jointly by Martin Pengelly and Lauren Gambino. The piece is titled Kyrsten Sinema, Arizona Democrat Censure Senator for Voting Rights Failure. The Arizona Democratic Party has formally censured Kyrsten Sinema, the U.S. senator whose opposition to filibuster reform helped sink attempts to protect voting rights. In a statement on Saturday, 22nd of January, the Arizona Party Chair, Raquel Taran, said, "While we take no pleasure in this announcement, the ADP Executive Board has decided to formally censure Senator Kyrsten Sinema as a result of her failure to do whatever it takes to ensure the health of our democracy." The attempt to pass voting rights legislation died in the Senate recently, a huge blow to President Joe Biden and his party, in a year which finishes with midterm elections in which Republicans are expected to prosper. Kyrsten Sinema supported two bills, but they were blocked by Republicans after hours of emotional and at times deeply personal debate over voting rights, racism, and the fragility of American democracy. U.S. Republicans were able to block the bills because Sinema and another moderate Democrat, Joe Manchin of West Virginia, opposed the move to carve voting rights issues out of the filibuster, the Senate rule which most legislation requires 60 votes to progress. Saying she opposed reform because the filibuster protected the rights of the minority, Kyrsten Sinema said in a flawed speech, "She was committed to doing my part to avoid toxic political rhetoric, to build bridges, to forge common ground, and to achieve lasting results for Arizona and this country." Critics point out that not only do Republicans in the 50-50 Senate represent millions of fewer Americans than Democrats, but the GOP itself was recently happy to change filibuster rules to require only a simple majority to confirm Supreme Court justices. Former U.S. President Donald Trump was therefore able to nominate three hardline conservatives to a Supreme Court which had already gutted federal voting rights protections. Since that Supreme Court decision in 2013, and at a growing pace since Trump refused to concede defeat in 2020, Republican state governments have passed laws which critics say are meant to make it harder for communities which lean Democratic, particularly black voters, to cast their ballots. Mitch McConnell, the Senate Republican leader, stoked uproar recently when, after the failure of the Democratic voting rights push, he said, "The concern is misplaced because if you look at the statistics, African American voters are voting in just as high a percentage as Americans." Diana DeGette, a Democratic representative from Colorado, said, "African American voters are Americans, and to suggest otherwise is about as racist as it gets." Critics say other Republican measures will make it easier for the GOP to overturn election results. In her statement on Saturday, 22nd of January, Raquel Taran said, "The Arizona Democratic Party is a diverse coalition with plenty of room for policy disagreements." She said, "However, on the matter of the filibuster and the urgency to protect voting rights, we have been crystal clear in the choice between an archaic legislative norm and protecting Arizonans' rights to vote. We chose the latter, and we always will." Raquel Taran praised Kyrsten Sinema's role in passing COVID relief and a bipartisan infrastructure bill, key parts of Joe Biden's agenda, but she also highlighted Republican attempts to audit and overturn Donald Trump's defeat in Arizona and election laws being passed nationwide. She said, "The ramifications of failing to pass federal legislation that protects the right to vote are too large and far-reaching." A spokeswoman for Senator Kyrsten Sinema said, "During three terms in the U.S. House and now in the Senate, Kyrsten has always promised Arizonans she would be an independent voice for the state, not for either political party. She's delivered for Arizonans and has always been honest about where she stands. Nonetheless, the senator has suffered significant blowback. Bernie Sanders, the Vermont senator and leading progressive, said recently he could back primary challengers to Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema in 2024. Sinema also saw Emily's List, a so-called right group, withhold its endorsement. In a statement, Emily's List president, LaFonza Butler, claimed, "We believe the decision by Senator Kyrsten Sinema is not only a blow to voting rights and our electoral system, but also to the work of all partners who supported her victory and her constituents who tried to communicate the importance of this bill." According to OpenSecrets.org website, a Democratic fundraising juggernaut, Emily's List was Kyrsten Sinema's top political donor in her 2018 Senate race. Another so-called right group, Naral Pro-Choice America, said it would only endorse senators who support changing the Senate rules to pass the critical legislation that will protect voting rights. Arizona's other Democratic senator, Mark Kelly, was on Saturday, 22nd of January, fundraising off his decision to support filibuster reform on voting rights matters, which he said was a tough one, but the right one for Arizona and our country. "The effects of censure by a state party are debatable. In Arizona, the Republican John McCain was censured in 2014 for what his state party deemed too liberal a voting record. The senator and 2008 presidential nominee John McCain took it in his stride as part of his public image as a political maverick. Kyrsten Sinema won the Arizona Senate seat vacated by Jeff Flake, an anti-Trump conservative, and also presents herself as unbound by traditional political codes. Last year, Chuck Coughlin, a former Republican operative in the state, told The Guardian, "Kyrsten Sinema was a pragmatist who understands that if she is to succeed in Arizona, she must succeed in this lane." However, Sandra Cole, a Democrat who once campaigned for Kyrsten Sinema, said, "She's not John McCain. She's not a maverick. I didn't agree with him on many things, but at least we knew where he stood."
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, fertility prevention. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of the fertility prevention in the Islamic lifestyle. Well, we can see that according to the Islamic teachings, it is very clear that Muslims should not prevent from fertility, or the fertility prevention is being not recommended by the Islam. But in the special cases, for example, if there is an issue and the doctor says that in order to save the womb or the health of mother or the woman, they should prevent from having child or children, then obviously in these cases Islam does allow them, because it is the matter of science and the specialist who is the doctor. This is the doctor who is recommending this in order to save the life of mother or in order to save the life of a person. So if this is the case, then obviously Islam says, yes, you should prevent it. But on the other side, Islam does not allow us to have this. And why? Because it causes many issues. It causes psychological issues. It causes issues in the families. It causes the unpeaceful environment in the house or in the society as well. It causes many, many other things. It causes depression in the parents as well. So therefore, it is necessary to look at the Islamic teachings and to follow the footsteps of Islam. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of fertility prevention in the Islamic lifestyle. We said that Islam does not allow it. Why? Because there's many things in it. For example, sometimes, you know, the general idea which is given, the advertisements, the propaganda which has been raised through the some like material system, non-Islamic systems, and they said that you should, the fertility prevention should be spread amongst the people so that people do not have many kids. Why? Because they will have the issue of, for example, like providing sustenance, and they cannot train the kids, they cannot raise kids, they cannot have a happy life with the kids. The happy life is only when there is only the couple, and so on. There are many things which has been propagated against having kids, against the fertility. But obviously, if someone prevents it, and this prevention will result in the damage, or it will result in the loss of the next generation. For the next generations, in order to continue, we should bring more children. And there are many issues. I can give a lot of examples. For example, in the UK, they had at a time when they said that because the natives are having less kids, therefore in the parliament they will have less native people, rather they will have those people in the parliament who are from other countries who migrated and now they are the citizen of the UK. So we can see many examples in the history, many things. I just gave one example which is on the news and you can just check it. So these are the things basically. So this is not just a problem of Islam. In any country, in any nation, if you see, the first problem is that people are not having kids and they are not educating their kids. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.